Hey, I'm Eric Tornberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Ariel Zuckerberg. Ariel is a former product manager at Human, Wildfire, and is a new partner at Kleiner Perkins. This episode, we talk about the transition from product manager to angel investor to working at Kleiner, how her life has changed due to her last name, her senior thesis on the morality of artificial intelligence, and much, much more. This is a fascinating episode. All right, here's Ariel.
So if you know, Al Gore made The Inconvenient Truth, if you could make a documentary on anything, what would you make it on?
Oh, man. That's a really interesting question. Probably the Wild West that is design in virtual reality right now. A lot of people are making users sick because they don't understand the effect that virtual reality has on the vestibular system and how people are learning how to kind of deal with that is really fascinating. And it improves every year. It's awesome.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. And I want to start with kind of what you identified when we hung out, which is like, did you say, you didn't say the elephant in the room, you said the big giant in the room? Do you remember what you called it?
Oh, the gorilla. The gorilla. 100 pound gorilla.
100 pound gorilla in the room. And you said, and you even mentioned it in your bio, in this AMA. So let's just start from the beginning and then we'll get out to, your time at, Human, also Kleiner, and what you're thinking about as you become an investor. So everyone here has seen the Social Network, when Facebook got big, when Mark was at college. But little do they know that, Ariel was, how old were you when things were popping up? Were you in 9th grade, 10th grade?
Yeah, something like that. I think I was in 10th or 11th grade.
Okay, before this happened.
I was in.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was a senior in high school when Facebook launched in high schools.
That's funny. Did, were you like one of the first high school students on it?
I was actually on vacation in Mexico and the internet was really bad. So I was the second or third high schooler on it. One of my best friends, snuck in before me, which is pretty funny.
And were you reluctant? Were you like, fine, I'll help out? Or were you like, no, this is going to be amazing. I can't wait. Oh my God. I'm so supportive.
I was so pumped. I immediately recreated all of the, those groups about Clippy and all those random.
Did you have a MySpace?
You guys remember those? Oh, actually, wait. Okay, funny you should mention that. Check out this water bottle.
What?
Vintage MySpace water bottle. I got this at TechCrunch 50 before it was TechCrunch Disrupt.
Did you know Tom personally?
No, I did not know Tom personally.
You haven't.
Oh, I wish I did though. Kindled that would be awesome.
Yeah, I bet Tom. I know Tom will be listening to this. We can arrange that final meeting. So before this all happened, what were you like in high school?
So granted this was like private school on the East Coast, but I was actually considered a jock in high school.
You were a jock.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of hard to believe as a kind of scrawny 5'6". I was a captain all three seasons my senior year, most of my life. So I did a volleyball, fencing, which is a Zuckerberg tradition, and spring track. Mm-hmm. And I threw javelin at, for spring track.
Wow.
It was pretty random.
This.
But yeah, so most of my life was sports. After school, I would play sports, and then I did travel volleyball as well. My social life really revolved around that.
And so, things started popping off as you became, a junior, a senior. How did that change your life?
I think a lot of my older friends were really excited to go to college and get a Facebook account. But it didn't really have a huge effect until I'd say sophomore, junior year of college. But at first it was just oh, cool. People are starting to know this website. I mean, my family and I used to celebrate what now seems like really small wins. The first 100,000 users, things like that. but it, I don't know if it was really like a recognized name brand outside of college until like sophomore, junior
of college
for me. Yeah.
And
so like 2008 or nine.
Is that when people started to realize that like they treated you differently when they hear the Zuckerberg last name? When did that, like, tell me about the first moment.
Yeah. I think like when I first got to school, people would kind of like whisper about it on campus. People started to develop like expectations about me before they had even met me. And they would say things like, if I met them at a party and they didn't know like that it was me or something, and then they found out, they would say things like, wow, like that's crazy. I didn't know. And I was like, what do you mean you didn't know? Would that have changed our interaction? So I started to realize there was a difference between my like first interactions with people who knew, like it seemed like they were a little more guarded and they were trying to act a certain way because they had certain expectations about me, versus talking to people who, you know, didn't know and were, you know, I guess more authentic and open with me or something like that.
And no new friends, as the philosopher Drake has advised.
Yeah, it was that was very interesting. To I still don't get that to this day. Like how does that change, you know, how you would have addressed me or acted towards me, like if you had known, versus like this conversation we were able to have with you not knowing this thing about me.
And you're like, wait, I'm a jock.
yeah exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, a jock on East Coast private school though is like a very,
yeah, I too was a scrawny jock on the East Coast, captain of my varsity basketball team, but in college had to redefine myself, and so did you, right? Like what did you get into in college?
A bunch of stuff. Well, computer science, which is awesome, and
philosophy.
That
right?
Was, yeah, philosophy. Those are my majors. But I got really into computer science. Like I started to do I wrote like the site for the school newspaper. Like I helped out with that. So my extracurriculars, I guess, were also related to, you know, techie stuff. Mm-hmm.
And as things started to like really scale, I imagine towards the end of your college career, how did you think about, you know, what you wanted to do in life and sort of the legacy that you wanted to leave? How has that evolution happened?
Yeah. So there was this, so my senior year, was when like the Time magazine, Mark was on the cover of the Time magazine. And that like, that really changed things. Like that kind of changed the way I had to go about, like living my life in some ways. I need to be like a little more careful, a little more guarded. And that happened to be during the time where I was writing my senior thesis. So I wasn't as like focused. I was focused on all these other things that were happening in my life. Come March, I was like, man, I haven't even started looking for a job yet. And my sister, Randy, she was like, you should just come up to the Bay Area. I'll like set some stuff up. She set up 8 interviews for me in one day and just had me talk to a bunch of people. And those relationships have really like, I'm still friends with those people to this day. And really set off my career to an amazing start. I ended up working with Alana Victoria from Wildfire. And they were my first interview of the day at like 8 a.m.
Well, first tell us about your senior thesis. I think it's fascinating.
To combine computer science and philosophy, I did moral agency and advancements in artificial intelligence.
And the conclusion was, or what was like the...
That if you... similar to what Turing talks about in The Imitation Game, not that I'm comparing myself, but how he says that what computers do is also thinking. They just think in a different way. So by that, if you assign moral agency to us, to artificial intelligence, you must also assign moral agency.
So computers are people.
Or computers are moral agents, potentially.
Like, yeah.
I mean, they'll start making moral decisions.
Interesting. And
or in the realm of ethics.
Did you think that you might get into artificial intelligence, like build something in that space?
I don't know. Honestly, like, so how I started off my career as a product manager, I took this course, Large Software Development at Harvey Mudd, or as the Mudders called it, LSD. And I had a group of, it was a group of four students, and we had a grant to write educational software for low-income middle school students. And it was like four engineers, but we had this stud in our group. His name is Stuart Pernsteiner. If you see him, hire him. And we just kind of deferred to him on all architectural decisions. And I ended up, I was also taking UI design at the time. So I ended up doing all these like softer skills. And I was also doing the design. I was doing like user testing and talking to the customers, which were like sixth graders, which is all stuff that like product managers do. And I ended up loving that. So because of Stuart Pernsteiner being such a rock star, I was like, wow, I discovered product management while I was in college working on this educational software. And I was like, wow, I wish I could do this like forever, which is funny because I'm not doing that anymore. But yeah. I was you know, really excited about that and wanted to find a career in that direction. So thank you, Stuart.
Yeah, so you and Wildfire, was it the idea? Was it the founders?
Yeah, the founders are amazing. Also, the size was perfect for me just starting out my career. It was like, I think it was 60 or 70 people at the time. It was just small enough that it still felt like a close-knit startup where I could have, you know, a decent amount of impact, but it was big enough where I would have mentorship and, you know, a lot of people to learn from. You know, I didn't have to, you know, jump in and do it all myself.
Right. So you were PM for a few years.
So about a year and a half ago, I started angel investing. About 2 years ago, I rekindled my friendship with this guy, Tyler Willis, who was one of the people my sister introduced me to.
Nice.
He's an angel investor, and we just kind of like caught up over coffee. And he was like, I'm thinking of teaching a class on angel investing. Do you know anyone who would want to be a guinea pig? And I'd be like, shit, I'll be a guinea pig. And the first class, I hosted in my living room. It was like me and four other students. And I had to borrow a monitor from a neighbor because I didn't have one. And he taught me like everything I know about angel investing. So I've been doing that. And it was just so fulfilling to like support, help entrepreneurs who are like building the future that you want to see. And in the process, like learn about different markets, kind of get your like business school education, if you will. So like that combination, I was like, this is amazing. Just, I can't really do this full time because I'm losing so much money.
Right.
or, you know, investing so much money, but like.
Losing.
Yeah. Most likely at the end of the day. But, and it just like wasn't a sustainable, like full-time career path, but I loved it. And I was like, how can I make this my full-time thing? This would be awesome.
What were some of the lessons or takeaways you learned while angel investing? Or any big mistakes you can put, without naming names, of course.
Well, it's very early to say because none of them have like kind of none of them have exited yet. A couple have like I've done follow-ons, but that's the thing about this in this you know field. It's so hard to like understand what your mistakes are and learn from them because the cycles are so long. But I think, so something I would definitely do is, so you can do, as an angel investor, you can go lone wolf, which is like, you're the sole decision maker. You go out, you talk to entrepreneurs, like you have access to the people you have access to, and that's it. And you write the small check, like comparatively to other, you know, other investors or institutional investors. So that's one option. There are other options which I didn't explore previously, which are angel groups and syndicates. I just recently invested in my first angel list syndicate. And if you do it, I think starting off, I did lone wolf, but when you do it through an angel group or a syndicate, you actually have access to like, you know, more deal flow because it's not just your network. You have everyone in the angel group's network. You also have access to like more varying areas of expertise, like not just my own. what else? And together, your check size as a syndicate or angel group is much bigger than yours would be personally. So you, as a group, you kind of have more power, I guess. And furthermore, you only have to do like $1,000 investments versus like, you know, at least 10, 15,000.
Right. So, Tyler Willis was just teaching me about angel-less syndicates, just to bring us all full circle.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Oh, he's amazing, man.
Yeah. Shout out to him. And he's starting his own podcast too, I believe.
For angel-less, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So when you were angeling, how much of it was space or theme driven versus, you know, founder driven or just being opportunistic about it? Or
it was a combination at first. My first investment, Partender, shout out to Nick if he's on here, the CEO. Nice, yay. I met him through a close friend of mine from college. So that was like very people driven, and I had heard about that company from a bunch of friends, and it was awesome. I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. My first deal. Like, and it was so exhilarating to write that check. And it was mostly because of him, because of Nick and how awesome he is, how he's definitely an industry expert, has a great head on his shoulders, knows how to like corral, you know, a team. He's just a great founder. And I mean, the product is awesome as well. The opportunity is huge. But anyway, so that was mostly like people, you know, connections through friends. Then the next couple I did were both in like insect protein. Those are very thesis driven, very like long game there. So thesis is that, you know, the way we farm beef and poultry is completely unsustainable. Insects are going to drive the global food supply in the future, or alternative meat sources are going to drive the global food supply in the future. And however, currently the, you know, price per pound is too high in the West. So in order for this to become a reality, you need to figure out ways to, you know, make this appealing to Westerners and also drive down the price per pound. Mm-hmm. So that was like a very thesis-driven investment. So just kind of a mixed bag, which is good when you're angel investing. You kind of need like the perfect storm when you're in institutional investor.
Yeah, and so now you're, you know, now you're a Kleiner. You're writing much bigger checks. Is it all, you know, are you looking for spaces first and making, you know, and what spaces or how are you thinking about it now that you're a Kleiner?
So right now, because I'm so new here, I'm trying to cast a pretty wide net and see as much as possible to kind of calibrate. So I'm seeing companies across like pretty much all sectors. I'm seeing like hardware, like consumer hardware. I'm seeing components. I'm seeing, you know, consumer digital, seeing enterprise, seeing like enterprise marketing, enterprise platform and infrastructure. So Kleiner as a firm invests across all sectors, health and security, pretty much everything. So I'm personally trying to figure out, you know, what I like and where my preferences lie, because honestly, like, it's a waste of both my time and the entrepreneur's time if I'm not like super pumped already going into the meeting about what they're doing.
How are you thinking about educating yourself or like accelerating that learning curve? Is a lot of it like following partners in other meetings? Is a lot of it outbound, making your own meetings? Like, how are you training yourself?
Yeah, so I get pulled into a lot of meetings with the GPs, which is awesome, because I get to, those are great. And it also makes me feel really good, because it makes me feel like they value my perspective. And it seems like they've been asking, pulling me into more and more things. So that's been great. I also get a decent amount of inbound. Like, once people find out that you're a VC, it's like pretty amazing. People who are like, I have a friend like who's like raising a Series A, and like they just talked to Sequoia last week. Like, do you want to talk to them? I'm like, yeah, of course I do. So that's been awesome. Like, my friends have really been sending me super high quality stuff, which is great. So it's like a lot of inbound, a lot of, you know, being pulled into GP meetings. And I've done a little bit of outbound as well, but mostly like prompted by inbound, if that makes sense. Like people being like, hey, I know someone, do you, like, here's their info if you want to reach out, things like that.
But I presume you have to say no a lot of times.
Oh man. So I'm pretty bad at saying no. So this is where I've had to learn the fastest and grow the fastest, is like delivering the quick and helpful. It's not really no, it's like not right now.
Yeah.
Usually, because you never want to close the door.
It's not you, it's me.
It's not you, it's me, and the timing is bad. Because, I mean, if they prove you wrong, so I always say why no. So I try to be helpful because, you know, you want to inspire the entrepreneur to prove you wrong. And if they can prove you wrong, then, like, you want the door to be open. You want them to come back and be like, look, I proved you wrong. Like, you know, we did this. We were able to like scale this random thing that you thought, I don't know, that's a bad example, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You never want to be like, it's over. Boom. I think I've gotten a little better at that, but yeah, that's definitely it. So something I've learned in life in general is just because something's simple doesn't mean it's easy. Like, in theory, it's very simple to, like, you know, that short email that's fast and like, you know, very respectful of their time and helpful, just like concise, and you just give it to them. Cool. But like, that's actually a very hard thing to do, even though it's so simple. I don't know. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
But you were talking about as you became a VC, people started to treat you a little differently. And then you were talking about earlier, you know, how people were treating you differently, like in college. What, you know, in the various stages of your life, what is, you know, people have been treating you differently for different reasons. And that happens to, you know, a lot of people to a certain degree, but to you a little bit elevated given your job and given your background. What does that make you think about people? Or like, how do you respond to that? How do you make sense of that?
I'll answer like, how do I make sense of that? Or I'll just kind of like summarize. So when I was a product manager, or I'll even go before that, like, so my last name, what people associate, or the expectations they have and what they associate with the name Zuckerberg, to be like totally blunt, is like money, access to capital, access to connections. And those things, when you're a product manager, don't have very much to do with your day-to-day work. So the fact that people would reach out to me regarding, you know, these assumed, you know, assumed access to capital and connections was like very unrelated to, you know, what I was doing and what I was trying to like be good at in my career. So that was kind of frustrating. But now that I'm in VC, those things are actually super related to what I do. I mean, directly related. Like, those expectations are like a positive thing. Like, it leads people to think, like, access to capital, access to connections, like, those are the reasons why you pick one firm over another. I mean, that's been a huge change for me. Like, the very things that were a burden, honestly, before, when I was a product manager, are actually like quite helpful now that I'm a VC.
So you welcome it as for all the opportunities. To make an analogy that's a little bit silly, my younger brother is in awe of all of my success and the legacy I've left. And he's gone into real estate to kind of escape it, because my legend looms so long, so large over him. How have you being the youngest, how have you thought about, and maybe not at all, but like, you know, the things that you want to accomplish separate from what other people already perceive without knowing you, or is there any, or is it, maybe I'm just inventing something.
No, I think I like kind of owe it to the world in some ways. I don't want to sound like, you know, Atlas, I have the world on my shoulders or anything, but I mean, I am in such a unique position where I've been kind of like handed a megaphone without totally deserving it, and haven't had to do much to like build a brand, and I have this strong brand associated with me. And I think people, you know, rightfully so, people are hopefully holding me accountable to like turn that, to like use this and leverage it to my advantage, not in my advantage, in the world's advantage, like my advantage so that I can create a lot of value in the world in a, you know, more straightforward way than other people couldn't necessarily. Does that make sense?
No, that makes a ton of sense. I should tell that to my brother, you know, given the great opportunities I've given him.
I kind of been, you know, my starting point, I've been kind of like given a, like a 17 stroke handicap or something. And like, if I can't get a, you know, a birdie at the very least with that, like, it's kind of, I kind of owe it to the world, you know what I mean? To be able to create a lot of value.
Do you feel under like a, is that a lot of pressure that you put in yourself, or?
I think I feel good about it because people have been so supportive. Especially people who feel like they owe a lot to Mark for some reason. Like Dave Morin, for example, reached out to me and it was like, I want to take you under my wing and like teach you everything I know about investing. I'm like, oh my God, yeah. That's amazing. And like, I have done very little to deserve that, if anything, honestly. But people like, people want me to succeed because like, I don't know, I'm so well positioned to have a positive impact.
Yeah, and you've earned your chops as a product manager at three different, you know, varyingly successful but very interesting companies, and have been helpful to other founders. And, you know, we were talking about this a bit, like, this leads to my next question. A lot of different firms wanted to hire you, and you could have, you know, had your pick of a number of great firms, and you explored different options, but eventually chose Kleiner, which was a fascinating choice, or was an awesome choice for you, as you say. What was that process like? And also, you know, for you, but also, what advice would you have for other people going through a similar process in terms of which VC to pick?
So I have a really good friend at Kleiner. So his name is Alex Kurland. He's amazing. If you haven't heard of him, you will for sure in like a year or two. He sourced Slack here, and he's awesome. He's on the growth side, but he's a great friend. And he, so having a great friend at the firm is obviously super helpful. Someone you like really respect and would love to, it'd just be fun to work with them. So that was something Kleiner had going for them, just like right off the bat without really any of the characteristics of the firm. But Kleiner is, the people here, it's so much about the people, whereas other firms are just plainly not as much about the people, or like I didn't click as well with the people as I did at Kleiner. Like I really felt here that people were gonna go out of their way to and like bend over backwards to ensure that a great experience, and that I would become a great VC. The mentorship here and just the environment, it's like very warm and collaborative, and other firms just really aren't like that. And it really like reflects on how we, the value we provide to entrepreneurs as well. Like we work as a team. Like I alone cannot provide that much value to entrepreneurs, but like the entire team here at Kleiner definitely can, with like the wisdom and experience and like diversity of perspectives. So the fact that we work so well together and like really genuinely like hanging out together, I think is a huge plus, like for me as an employee here, but also for like what we're doing.
Which is awesome to hear, because you know, if the only thing you knew about Kleiner, if you knew nothing about Kleiner, but the only thing you knew was kind of, if you followed the Ellen Powell case or just kind of PR, you wouldn't know necessarily how awesome, you know, the people I've, you know, bunch of friends there. And so it's great to hear that.
Yeah, it's awesome here. It's like, feel a very strong bond with my teammates. It's really awesome environment.
And what spaces are you most excited about right now?
Yeah. So I'm really excited about VR. I just think, I don't know. I just think like the classrooms of the future, like our kids will find it weird that we didn't experience the Mayan ruins like in 3D. They're gonna be like, what? Like, how did you even understand what was going on? You know, in you know, the Civil War, like, what the hell? So I kind of see that. What else? Access over ownership, I think, is gonna continue to be really big. What else? I actually made a list because I figured you would ask this.
Talk more about access versus ownership for those who may not be familiar.
Oh yeah. So like renting, so like Airbnb, for example, or like, you know, taking Uber instead of owning a car. So it, what happened here? Sorry. So it the main like benefits are, it removes the burden of large fixed costs for something that you're not going to use very often. Yeah, that's like the main benefit of it. You know, you only pay for it when you access it versus paying to own something like a vehicle. I think like sporting equipment will be a big one as well. Mm-hmm. And just like continuing this trend of people like only paying for things when they're utilizing them.
Yeah. And how much of your time is helping existing portfolio companies? And if there are other spaces you want to talk about, feel free to add those.
Other stuff, food is obviously, like a lot of my angel investments are in food. I just think that that's, there's, like I said, a lot of work to be done there. And I have a thesis about that. We can talk about that another time. I think I told you a little bit about that though, like the Prius thing.
Yep, but tell our audience a bit.
This actually came out of a conversation with Simon from Greylock, but we were talking about how basically the idea was that, similar to like gas-guzzling SUVs, and how, you know, there's this kind of inflection point where people started to feel ashamed of owning gas-guzzling SUVs, and then that shame became, or there was guilt, and then people started to shame people who owned SUVs because they're like bad for the environment and things like that. And I think the same thing is kind of happening with food. Like, there's this guilt about eating things that you don't know where they come from and you don't know what's in them. And people are starting to see the same kind of shame that people experience with these gas guzzling SUVs and Hummers with the type of food you eat and support and buy. So the same way that the Prius kind of came in and like made it really easy to make the environmentally right decision. Mm-hmm. Like, you saw people across socioeconomic areas, like everyone's buying the Prius. It was like this statement about you caring for the environment. And I think we're soon going to see like the Prius of food, kind of like whatever, it makes it really easy to make the right decision in food. Mm-hmm. I think I explained it better the first time when we were at dinner, but yeah, hopefully that was...
That was good.
That was...
How much of your time is helping existing portfolio companies? And what do you do there?
So not as much right now, because it's only been 5 weeks, but I've been helping some of my angel portfolio companies. Like, I visit the bartender office, I don't know, once a month. But I talk to Nick more often. I have a couple meetings set up with like portfolio companies that I'm interested in, but I haven't really yet started to like, you know, be super helpful, to be totally honest.
Yeah, no. There's a few questions here about your, and I know you're obviously just starting at Kleiner Perkins and want to be an investor for quite a while, but your long-term goals or plans, do you think of yourself as having kind of, you know, in 10 years, I want to be doing X, Y, Z? You know, Nikhil asks here if you potentially see yourself in politics. You are in Al Gore's room after all.
Okay, how do you think about that? Me making the same face as Al Gore. That's
the writing is on the wall. How do you think about kind of the broader question of like long-term career?
Man, I kind of shy away from it. I don't know. No, I think I'm more like, rather than seeing it as a career path, it's more like goal-oriented, I guess. I'd say it's more like, okay, once I feel like I've like achieve this goal, then I'll, you know, move on to the next thing. Or when I've reached a point where I feel like I kind of need to like learn something new and in order to like level up.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
And right now,
you're focused on learning how to like being a great investor, essentially, you would say.
Yeah. And I think if you ask me that question like a couple of months, because right now I'm so focused on like getting off to a good start here, I'm like 100% on that. I'm like not thinking as much about super long-term career goals right now. But I don't know, in like a year when I can like reflect on and hopefully learn a little bit, even though the learning cycles are super long in investing, I can like look back and see, then ask me that question, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. No, follow-up podcast.
Yeah, I have to understand whether or not I'm a good investor in order to know that this is like the right thing for me.
Right.
If I'm bad and I don't provide that much value and don't have very good investment judgment, then I should probably, you know,
cross that bridge.
Ask Randy to set up more interviews.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of like kind of large career thoughts, what's the best advice you've ever heard?
Relating to investing specifically.
Yeah, sure.
Does interesting advice count? Okay, cool. I was having dinner with Luke Nosek, and I asked him if he could start over, all over again, what would he do differently in terms of investing? And he said that he would write down every thought as it happened, okay? And he would have two different colored pens, and he would write down all of his rational thoughts in one color and all of his emotional thoughts in another color. And then kind of try to find patterns in his emotional thoughts and like analyze them later. I thought that was just very interesting, not necessarily like super feasible, but I think the point though of what he's saying, I think is super valuable, which is like understanding why you are thinking a thought, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word, will help you like understand like which of your like decisions or opinions are based on like, you know, biases that are clouding your judgment, or are like you actually like being rational and like thinking clearly.
Have you been following this advice yet?
I've been trying to trying to understand. So what I found is that sometimes what you think are rational thoughts are actually emotional thoughts disguised as rational thoughts. Like, this is just an easy example. I've never personally felt this way, but if you're like, you know, this founder seems really, disrespectful or not a good listener, you just have to make sure, you have to like unpack that and make sure that you just don't have like a, you know, unfair bias like against that person, or you just like thought that person was a jerk, so you decided to pretend that you think that they were a bad listener.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What's something that you used to strongly believe that you changed your mind on, that you now see as misguided in some way?
So this might turn out to be misguided also, but I used to believe that people were bad at assessing mid-range risk. And I'm starting to think that maybe not all people are bad at assessing. Like, it could be that women are great at assessing mid-range risk and guys aren't.
Can you give an example?
So mid-range risk is something that you believe to be like a 2 or 3x return, especially at early stage. So what you think is like kind of an obvious a 2 or 3x is like, so Peter Thiel advises against this because it either has to be like something you believe is an 100x or you don't do it. Like, it has to, you have to believe that it's going to return your entire portfolio and that, you know, you're setting yourself up for failure if you don't invest in things that are like, if you invest in things that you think are 2 or 3x, because humans are really bad at this, and therefore, like, you just need to go for the things that you think are going to be grand slams. Because you're probably wrong about the 2 or 3x. Like, the things you think are safe bets aren't actually safe bets. And I'm not necessarily think that I, like, totally don't believe that, but I think that I think it would be like an interesting thought experiment to see if there are different types of people. Like, I know when he probably made that assertion, most investors were male, and I'm just wondering now that there are more female investors, if, you know, this is still true among those investors as well. I don't know, just
it's interesting. How many women are on the Kleiner investment? There are others, right? I mean, Mary Meeker's on the growth team.
Yeah, so Mary Meeker's on the growth team. Beth Seidenberg is on the venture team. And also Swathi is also on she's an associate like me on the venture side.
Yeah, interesting. So I'm going to say a space, and I want you to tell me your quick thoughts on it. You could either just say overrated or underrated, or you could elaborate.
Okay.
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin itself, I think is overrated, but the blockchain is very interesting to me, especially smart contracts. I learned about these very recently. Contracts that are executed programmatically and automatically based, like, imagine, you know, if you break some law and it like automatically, it can like programmatically determine, or like a swear jar. Like, if you kind of hook up your text input to a smart contract, and every time you swear, like, money is extracted from your account, it would automate that process. So these smart contracts, I think, are super interesting and I think very promising.
We talked about VR already. You're very excited about it. How about artificial?
I think it'll be like baked into everything. I don't know if it's like it's its own space per se. I think like every, just kind of like software is eating the world. I don't know. I think like artificial intelligence powered software will eat the world. I think it'll just like be part of everything.
And when you talk about VR, are you both excited about the hardware and the software?
Mostly the use cases, you know, similar to like how the iPhone in 2007 was like this watershed technological breakthrough that led to, you know, Snapchat and Uber, which made use of like specific sensors that made use of the platform. I think like VR will be like the technological breakthrough. And then like, I'm excited about the, you know, whatever the Snapchat and Uber are of VR.
How about education technology?
So I'm very excited about it. I don't actually know very much about the space, but it's important, and I really hope, I don't know enough about like the business side. But I know that like, I'm excited about personalized learning and things like that.
How about
New Zella is an exciting what?
Things like Meerkat or Periscope or even Blab. How about live?
So I love like Snapchat stories, and something I'm excited about with like live stream is being able to understand what it's like to be like put yourself in someone's shoes, like, you know, at any point, and kind of like, hopefully we can kind of create a museum, like a digital museum of these things, so that people will know what it was like in the past, like how we hung out, you know, how we had conversations like this. People in 50 years, I think they would find this interesting, this format. So I hope that like live streaming is great because it gets more like mundane content, like that we see as mundane now, but it's actually like super informative from like an anthropological perspective. Yeah. That we would never, that we have never had access to before, ever. Like, this will be the first generation of people that like we know all the like mundane shit that they did, right. Because yeah. of live streaming, and that's awesome. Like, I'm pumped about that because I don't know. I wish like I knew all the, like, it would be super cool to understand like people in Europe in the 20s, like what they did at, during a house party. Like,
yeah. How about? Yeah. How about net neutrality or just internet policy broadly? Where your thoughts are?
I mean, I don't know very much about it, but I don't know enough about it to like express a strong opinion. I think I am pro net neutrality.
Yeah, for people who you know, have startup ideas or have startups that have traction, what is the best way to get on your or Kleiner's radar? Like, what advice do you have for founders?
Yeah, you can reach out to me via email or like attend an event with us or something. And yeah, engage with us in any way you can. We're always open to hearing about exciting companies with traction, especially.
You might get flooded.
So, yeah, that's fine. Okay. Bring it on.
Okay. Arielle at kpcb.com.
Yeah, Arielle at kpcb.com. Or you can like tweet at me or something. I'm pretty new to Twitter, to be honest. But you can definitely tweet at me. Yeah. Also.
Awesome. If you find the next big idea and from this podcast, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
What are you saying?
Yeah, well, it's gonna be recorded, so we'll look back.
Yeah. No, I mean, I know we talked about this, how I think you would be an amazing investor potentially down the line.
You're too kind. Okay, so I do want to respect your time. Lastly, I want to ask, do you have, you major in philosophy, you're obviously interested in a lot of different topics. Who are some of your favorite kind of thinkers, both whether it's past or current, whether it's in the field of philosophy or just kind of broad, you know, thinkers or writers that you really, really admire? What are some things that you recommend, you know, people hear?
So my favorite philosophical work and one of my just favorite books of all time in general is called The Symposium by Plato. So he hosts a symposium about the topic of love, and everyone at the symposium has to give a speech about, you know, the meaning of love, you know, what is love, etc. And they have a comedian, a tragedian. Oh no, the light in my office just turned off. Oh well, I'll just sit here in the dark. An aristocrat, I think like a bunch of people across several fields and their perspectives about like the meaning of love and, you know, why we feel this feeling and things like that. It's magical. Not only are like each of the perspectives interesting, but it also says something about how he views that genre or that occupation, and like through the lens of the subject of love, which is like this universal feeling, how these different practices, they play into like the human psyche and things like that. It's awesome. Definitely recommend it.
And readable.
Yeah, it's pretty, it's not like super long. Aristophanes is my favorite. He talks about how, originally two people were a blob together and then over time we separated. But it gave me this appreciation for comedy and how comedy like feels lightweight, but it's actually extremely profound. it can be extremely profound, and like, and it makes it even more profound because it's like veiled in humor and like this lightheartedness.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Ariel, with respect to time, this has been a fascinating interview. Thank you for doing it.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, it's always a pleasure. Last minute plugs. Where can people learn more about you, about Kleiner, about everything you're up to, and anything else you want to plug or tell the audience?
Yeah, so we have Kleiner has a cool podcast called Ventured, and hopefully I'll be on it soon, maybe.
Nice.
What else? We have a blog. We're all over the place. Come to our events, and yeah, I don't know.
Cool. Check you out on
Twitter. Follow me on Facebook and stuff.
And Facebook.
Yeah, I'm a lot more prolific on Facebook.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
I gotta stay loyal.
Yeah, awesome. So they can follow your page?
I have a profile on Facebook. Awesome. I'm verified though.
Okay.
So you know, I'm like a really big deal.
Yeah, no, I get it. Absolutely. Cool, Ariel. This has been awesome. And the audience can find you on Facebook, Twitter, email. Thank you for taking the time, and we'll chat soon.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric.